All right. Well, this is where I say it. So here we go. Turn with me, if you will, to the place where we begin this week's Torah portion. It is the first one after the giving of the Ten Deborim, or the Ten Sayings, Ten Commandments, and it starts in chapter 21 of the book of Exodus, or Shemot. And it starts this way with the word and, so we realize it's a continuation. They, Allah, and these are Hamishpatim. So the name of the Torah portion, therefore, is Hamishpatim, or just Mishpatim. Mishpatim, let's see, it's plural because it ends in im. And it's one of those three words, right? Hukat, mitzvot, and mishpatim, statutes, judgments, and commandments, or in some cases, ordinances. But anyway, these are the judgments, the other related things that are going to be part of the instruction, the entirety of the instruction that were given to Moshe. And it's really kind of interesting because this is considered to be, by most reckonings, the biggest, the most number of mishpatim, of specific commandments and ordinances and judgments that we see in any of the Torah. And it says, now these are those things which you shall set before them. And here we go. Now, I will also make one other introduction at this point, because I like to think that if you want to see a pattern here, you can. It begins with the word and. And it's kind of like, remember, the one way of stating the Ten Commandments is you got five that have to do the first half essentially with man's relationship to his Creator, and the second half, man's relationship to man. But another way of looking at it, I will contend, is here is how you are to live as a free people. I'm bringing you out of bondage. Here are the things you need to know. Here's how you live as a free people. And then the first thing that we see in this week's portion is, how about the alternative? How do we understand these elements and how it fits together to be free people? If you buy a Hebrew servant, what? Yeah. 6 years he shall serve. Oh, well, right there. See, that's different than, say, a U.S. tax slave, which serves forever. And even if you try to escape and go to a foreign country and become an expat, Big Brother will still think you owe taxes. And remember, in Egypt, the Hebrew slaves were told you got to pay 20% to Pharaoh. Most American tax slaves would figure that's a pretty great deal. In any case, what we're going to see here is there is a special category. This is not a slave. This is a bondservant, is probably a better rendering. And if you buy one, 6 years is all he shall serve. In the seventh year, he goes out free, doesn't know anything. If he comes in by himself, he shall go out by himself. If he's married, in other words, if he already had a wife, his wife is his, she goes out with him. Now, here is a part that shocks a lot of people, and sadly, you'll still see it. There may be a lot of things that Big Brother will tell you have been done away with and that don't apply anymore, and of course, the whole church will tell you the law is done away with, but ironically, this part, they're still big deal. They're still in favor of this part. If his master gives him a wife, and she bears him sons or daughters, guess what? The wife and her children belong to the master. And the man that had these things given to him goes out by himself. Now, I can't help but think there are parallels here. Yeah, if you ask for permission and the state gives you a wife, well, guess what? Don't think yourself that this is any different. The master still owns the slaves, the kids, the offspring, the output of the licensed marriage. If the servant plainly says, I love my master, and I love my wife, and I love my children, I don't want to go out free, then the master brings him before Elohim, and he shall bring him to the doorpost. And he literally nails his ear to the doorpost. He bores through his ear with an awl, and oftentimes, remember the custom, put a little earring in there to show that you're a slave, and then he shall serve him forever. And I sometimes make this observation. We in America tend to think, oh, this must be a really good master, right? The master is so beloved by the slaves that they don't want to leave. And I remember having a discussion with a late rabbi friend of mine. I've told this story many times, but I think it's really a kind of an eye-opener. He said, you know, the way we teach that is that that's a crappy master. The master has one main job. The point of being a bondservant in a Hebrew situation is to learn to Torah, to learn instruction, learn how to be a free man. And a master which does that, well, he sets his servant, his bondservant free. If he fails, that person has not learned how to be free, and that's the one that serves him forever. So it's an interesting contrast. And of course, if you think about it, that tends to be kind of the attitude of the American and indeed national, international slave as well. I love my master, the Almighty State. The man sells his daughter to be a maidservant. She shall not go out as the men servants do. Well, what kind of a man would sell his daughter to be a maidservant, to be essentially a wife, a concubine? And the answer is, this too is one of those things that has been, taught differently over the years. The way that I have also heard is understand the culture, understand the times. And if a man is poor and he can't offer his daughter much, and she's probably not going to be able to do much in life, he may say, well, how can I get her a better life? And essentially that is one of the ways that this is taught. It's the man says, how can I give my daughter a better life? To whom can I betroth her that will give her a better life? And what's interesting is, if you read the next couple of verses, it buttresses that claim. Because it says this, if she doesn't please her master, who has espoused her to himself, in other words, he has going to take her as a wife, then he is to let her be redeemed, in other words, bought back. Because he cannot sell her, he has no authority to sell her to a foreign people, seeing that he has dealt deceitfully with her. So what is the straight implication there? Yeah, she was betrothed as a wife here. If he does not do that, then he lets her be redeemed. Now, if in fact he espoused her to his son instead of taking her for himself, then he is to deal with her after the manner of daughters. In other words, this is exactly what is often taught this in this sense. It is a level of protection, and of course the protection is for the women. He deals with her as if it were his daughter. If that man takes himself another wife, he has one, he takes another one, or a third one, her food, her raiment, and her conjugal rights. In other words, the duties of marriage is how the King James sometimes translates it. Those things that the man is to do for his wife, to basically satisfy her and take care of her and cover her, he shall not diminish. Now, one of the things that you'll also see if you have a traditional ketubah, the marriage contract, it often includes those three elements. They're kind of considered to be the three minimum necessary conditions that a man should be able to provide for a wife. Food, clothing, duties of marriage. In other words, to be able to satisfy her and take care of her. Those are the three minimums. That doesn't mean that there aren't more. It just means that is the three minimums. Those are the ones that are usually in the ketubah. If he doesn't do these three things for her, then she does not owe him the money that he paid back. She goes out free. She does not have to provide any silver. Going to change gears next. He that smites a man so that he dies shall surely be put to death. So somebody takes a man and whacks him and as a result kills him. He is deserving of death. If a man doesn't lie in wait, though, but Elohim causes it to come to hand, in other words, it's not premeditated, then I would appoint a place where this man may flee. So this is often called the manslayer. And you notice the difference between these two commandments is intent. In one case, somebody smites a man so that he dies, he's deserving of death. On the other hand, if he doesn't lie in wait and it just happens because of some accident, elsewhere we'll see the example of their chopping wood and the axe handle lets loose and the axe head flies off and hits the poor guy in the head and kills him. Well, there is it's a shame, it's horrible, but the man who had the accident is not guilty of murder. He didn't plan it. If a man comes presumptuously upon his neighbor, aha, here's the opposite, to slay him with guile, then you shall take him from mine altar, that he may die. Rashi's understanding here, and I think this is reasonable, you could add the word even. In other words, I don't care where he is, even if he's standing at my altar, he's deserving of death. He that smites his father or his mother shall surely be put to death. And someone that kidnaps, steals a man, and then sells him, if he is found in his hand, he too is deserving of death. So kidnapping, selling somebody into slavery, is a penalty. Is a crime deserving of the death penalty. He that curses his father or mother, doesn't have to smite him, just curses them, shall surely be put to death. Now, if men fight or contend, one smites the other with a rock or a stone or with his fist, and he doesn't die, but he is bedridden. At the point where he is able to rise again and walk abroad upon his own, basically his own support, his own power, some renderings say on his staff, and my understanding from what I've seen of some of the Midrash is that's a mistake. It really means on his own support. And a staff might be support, but this is basically saying he doesn't need a staff. He is pretty much healed. If he still needs a staff, he's not healed. Okay, then the one that is responsible for putting them there, for smiting him, is free. He's quit. Only, he is to pay for the loss of his time, and he is to pay for his medical expenses. He is to cause him to be thoroughly healed. If a man smites his bondman or his bondwoman with a rod, and that person dies under his hands, he is to be punished. Notwithstanding, though, if the servant continues a day or two, he is not to be punished because he was bought with silver. Wow. If men strive together and they hurt a woman who is pregnant, she has a child, so that her fruit departs, she loses the child, yet no other harm follows, he is to be fined. And who sets the fine? The woman's husband lays the fine upon him, and he shall pay as the judges determine. So it sounds like there is at least one level of appeal here. The judges will say it's reasonable. This guy was really looking forward to a child, and now you've deprived him, and they've been trying for years. It's going to cost you. Anyway, if any other harm follows, you shall give. Life. Now, you've heard this one. I'm going to suggest that there's a mistranslation that's really worthy of paying attention to. You shall give life for life, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot. Let's pause. Because it's not for there. The Hebrew word, of course, is life. Nefesh, techat, nefesh. Soul for soul is actually another way to put it. The life, the soul are the same thing. But techat is an interesting Hebrew word. It's better translated, and I really like this understanding. It works almost everywhere you see this word in the Torah. Techat means in place of. So, what you're doing is replacing something in kind. An eye in place of an eye. A tooth in place of a tooth. Hand for hand. Tooth or a foot in place of foot. Burning in place of burning. Wound in place of wound. Stripe in place of stripe. Now, how do you do that? And, of course, the question is, if you put somebody's eye out, you cannot replace the eye. The reason why a lot of people say, oh, see, Torah is bad and evil, how, you know, you put out the guy's eye that did this, well, that's not necessarily the intent. And the way I like to explain it, of course, a lot of you have heard this, is ask the guy, and not that they'll give you a straight answer, but the concept at least makes sense, because measure for measure is what is being described here. What is your eye worth to you? Hey, dude, you through your carelessness, your negligence, you put out your neighbor's eye. He's going to suffer forever. You can't fix that. On the other hand, suppose we were to put out your eye. What would you pay him so that he doesn't do that? See, that puts a whole different spin on it, doesn't it? Now it's like the eye in place of an eye. What's your eye worth to you? Well, that's what you owe him. And I think that makes a heck of a lot more sense, and it also develops the understanding, shows the level of depth of what Torah is really trying to teach us here. Now, if a man smites the eye of his bondsman or of his bondswoman, and he destroys it, then that person is to be set free for the sake of his eye. Likewise, if he smites the bondsman's tooth or his bondswoman's tooth, that person is to be let go. Was going to be 7 years? Nope, they're out for the sake of the tooth. Next, we're going to see some things that have to do with liability and replacement and elements of, the kinds of things that are the basis of a lot of the common law back when we had that. If an ox gores a man or a woman and they end up dying, the ox is surely to be stoned. The ox is put to death. Its flesh shall not be eaten, but the owner of the ox is off the hook. He's quit. Now, on the other hand, here comes the caveat. If the ox was wont to gore in time past, in other words, if this isn't the first time, and we have seen evidence that this ox was nasty to begin with, and essentially what we're saying is the owner should have known. What the heck is going on here? Warning has been given to the owner. and he hasn't kept the ox in, but instead it's gotten out and killed a man or a woman. Now, yep, you got it. The ox is to be stoned, and also its owner shall be put to death. He has committed an act of gross negligence, resulting literally in death. He should have known better. And that is the penalty. If there is laid on him a ransom, in other words, okay, what is your life worth to you? Then he can be redeemed, and the redemption of his life is whatsoever is laid upon him. You got $1 million, okay, pony it over to the family or whatever the case may be here. But there is a ransom. He can redeem his life. And arguably, hopefully, he will not ever have that happen again. He's not going to be the same ox, that's for sure. Whether it's gored a son or has gored a daughter, according to this judgment, shall it be done to him. Now, if the ox gores a bondsman or a bondswoman, he shall give to that one's master 30 shekels of silver, and still the ox is stoned. We're seeing that there is an understanding here of the ways to try to make things right that shouldn't have, perhaps in a lot of cases, gone wrong to begin with. If a man opens up a pit, he digs a pit, or he digs a pit and doesn't cover it, and an ox or an ass falls into the pit, the owner of the pit is to make it good. He gives money to the owner of them, and the dead beast shall be his. So basically, you screwed up, an animal fell in there and was killed. Congratulations, you're making good on it. Your reward, or at least your slight compensation, you get to keep the dead animal. If someone's ox is hurt by another man's ox and it dies, then they are to sell the live ox and divide the price of that in half. The dead also they shall divide. So they sell the live ox, so none of them has an ox, neither one. But they divide the dead ox, and they divide the price for the live ox. So everybody is essentially made whole. You notice there is not the implication of liability or at fault here. If it's known, however, that the ox was wont to gore in times past, okay, same thing. So in this case, there is liability. The owner has not kept it in. He surely pays ox for ox, and the dead beast is what he gets. If a man steals an ox or a sheep and kills it, or he sells it, then he shall pay. Wow. 5 oxen for an ox and 4 sheep for a sheep. You stole it. Not only do you get caught, you're making good on it. You're going to provide 5 oxen in place of the one you stole. We have a slight change. There's a chapter break here. The next chapter is interesting, and this, of course, is one that I think hopefully folks have heard, but it's certainly interesting, and it's also very apropos because this is one that should be a lot more front and center in our modern society than it is. If a thief is found breaking in, all right, so you're home asleep, the thief is breaking in, you hear the glass break, go downstairs. What happens? There is no blood guiltiness. I like the Hebrews pretty blunt. He has no blood. When a thief breaks in and crosses the threshold, he has no blood, right? The life is in the blood. His life is already forfeit. You go down there, you see him, and you kill him, he was dead already. Does it make sense? And this is essentially at the heart of a lot of common law, the man's home is his castle doctrine. Somebody's breaking in your house, you don't have to ask the question, is he armed or not? You're allowed to make the presumption, my life, my wife's life, my children's life, I don't know what the guy's intentions are, but I'm going to assume that's the worst. And you have every right to kill him because he has no business being there, and he has no blood when he crosses the threshold. Now, there is a caveat in the next verse. If the sun has risen upon him, then he basically has blood again. Okay? There shall be blood guiltiness for him. He is instead now to make restitution. If he doesn't have anything, you sell him into bondage for his theft. If the theft be found in his hand alive, okay, so if he was stealing, say, an animal, he was cattle rustling, or an ox or an ass or a sheep, he pays double. If a man causes a field or a vineyard to be eaten, he shall let his beast loose, and it feeds in another man's field. Well, then, you replace that with what? The best of his own field, the best of his own vineyard. That is how he is to make restitution. If a fire breaks out, catches in the thorns, so that the shocks of corn or standing corn of the field are consumed, the person that kindled the fire shall surely make restitution. He's at fault, he makes it right. What a concept. I mean, imagine if we actually had this in society, we would have had the kind of society that we had for most of the time where we had people who actually walked in obedience. again, this is the essence of the common law, folks. Everything in here makes sense, and we're seeing that the society was a hell of a lot better off when we walked in that way. The man delivers to his neighbor money, or silver, in other words, or stuff, other things to keep, right here. Take care of my car while I'm gone. Take care of whatever it is. But it's stolen out of his house. Well, if the thief is found, he shall pay double. If the thief isn't found, now we got a problem. Was it really stolen or was it not? Is the guy lying? The master of the house shall come near before Elohim to see whether or not he has put his hand into his neighbor's goods. And there's an interesting implication here, too. It is that the people we're dealing with are God-fearing people, that they understand, literally, God-fearing, you're going to go before Elohim and swear you did or you didn't do this thing. You didn't steal his goods that he gave to you for safekeeping. For every manner of trespass, whether it's for an ox or an ass or a sheep, for clothing, anything that's lost, when one person says, this is it, then the cause of those two parties shall come before Elohim. The one whom Elohim shall condemn shall pay double to his neighbor. How much better the world would be. If a man delivers, and by the way, it should have been. And ironically, and I think we're going to see, this is my take on prophecy, we're going to see a time when it is. If a man delivers unto his neighbor an ass or an ox or a sheep or any kind of a beast to keep, and it dies or it gets hurt or is driven away, and nobody sees it, nobody knows what happened to it, well, then the oath of Yahuwah shall be between the both of them, to see again whether or not this man that had a responsibility put his hand unto his neighbor's goods. In other words, do we believe the story? He's going to swear before Elohim. Both men will enter into this agreement, and the owner shall accept it. He accepts the word of his neighbor. He is not to make restitution. If it is stolen from him, he shall make restitution to the owner thereof. If it's torn in pieces, and of course we saw this with the story of Joseph, if it's torn in pieces, then he brings the skin for a witness. He shall not make good that which was torn. Okay, here is the skin of the beast. Now remember, of course, as we saw in the story of Joseph, it's possible that people can lie. Shouldn't. And yet we know that that is often the case. Of course, the whole section here, we're talking about people that are stealing things and doing things that they shouldn't ought to have done. If a man borrows something from his neighbor, and whether it's hurt or it dies, the owner of it is not with it. In other words, we don't know what happened again. He surely shall make restitution. So you borrowed it, as opposed to him putting it in your hands to take care of it. He borrowed it. He's responsible for it. It's lost. It's stolen. It dies. He makes good on it. The owner is with it. He doesn't need to make it good. If it is a hireling, he loses his hire. So the hireling loses his the money that he would have earned. But if the owner is there, well, then he knows what's happened, and it is not made good. If a man entices, we've changed gears again. If a man entices a betula, a virgin, someone who is not betrothed, she's not been given to a man as a potential or a future wife, and he lies with her, he is surely to pay the dowry for her to be his wife. He owes the price, the bride price. Now, if the father of the bride utterly refuses to give this man to her, he has that option, obviously. This is consistent with Scripture, Numbers 30 and so forth. I don't want my daughter to go with you. Why would I want that? Yeah, he refuses to give her. He still pays the money according to the dowry of virgins. Here's an interesting one. You shall not suffer a sorceress to live. This is the first use. It was first used in Exodus chapter 7, verse 11, and we're seeing references here to Molech too, of the kinds of things that, well, I guess you could say we could see them today. Probably some of them in the Epstein letters. Whoever lies with a beast, bestiality we're talking, whoever lies with a beast shall surely be put to death. He that sacrifices unto the fake gods, the so-called Elohim, except only unto Yahuwah, shall be utterly destroyed. Sacrifice to Yah, okay. Sacrifice to fake gods, no. The stranger shall not, a stranger you shall not wrong, nor shall you oppress him, for you too were strangers in the land of Mitzrayim. You shall not afflict any widow or orphan or fatherless child. If you do, if you afflict them in any way, think about this, folks. How much of this have we seen? How much are we seeing in these emails and in the letters and so forth, and how much have we seen, period? If you afflict them in any way and they cry out to me at all, I will surely hear their cry. My wrath shall wax hot, and I will kill you with the sword. And your wives shall be widows, and your children fatherless. If you lend money to any of my people, even to the poor with you, you shall not be to him as a creditor, nor shall you lay upon him interest. And that's an interesting one. Of course, it's at the heart of a big difference between a Torah-based economy and one that based, as what we see today, on banksters and usury and all kinds of things that have huge effects on society. But basically what it does is it creates an eternal debtor class. And the economic reality is hard to deny. If you take it all, your neighbor's garment as a pledge, you shall restore it to him when the sun goes down, or by the time that the sun goes down. Because this is his only covering. It's his garment for his skin. And where is he to sleep? And it'll come to pass that if he cries out to me, I will hear, because I'm gracious. You shall not revile Elohim, nor shall you curse a ruler of your people. You shall not delay to offer the fullness of your harvest, of the outflow of your presses. The firstborn of your sons belongs to me, right? You shall give them to me. Likewise, you shall do that with your oxen and your sheep. 7 days it's with its mother. On the eighth day, you give it to me. And you shall be set apart, holy, kadosh men unto me. Therefore, you shall not eat any flesh that is torn of beasts in the field. That is to be cast to the dogs. It's dog food. Chapter 23, we change gears again, and I'm going to again note how much of this is, ironically, ignored today. But it sure, well, I guess you'd say if you want to be in Congress, yeah, consider the contrast here. You shall not utter a false report. Do not put your hand with the wicked to be an unrighteous witness. Do not put your hand with the wicked to be an unrighteous witness. Distance yourself from falsehood is another way that I've seen this concept rendered. The next verse is similar, but gives us a little bit more of a fleshing out. You shall not follow after a multitude to do evil. Doesn't matter how many vote to do evil, right? I don't care if 100 million people vote to steal somebody's stuff, take their property, or kill them. Do not follow that multitude to do evil. Period. Nor shall you bear witness in a cause to turn aside after a multitude. Oh, he done it. Nope. To pervert justice. These are powerful commentaries, powerful commandments, and sadly, at the heart of so much of the wickedness that permeates a nation that has forgotten him and turned to evil. You shall not turn aside, even after a multitude, to pervert justice. Nor shall you favor a poor man in his cause. All right? Now that's exactly the opposite of what we hear. Oh, somebody's poor. Yeah, we'll pervert justice all day long. It's kind of like the essence of DEI. All kinds of things that we're going to say social justice demands. Uh-uh. The Creator's justice is what's real. Don't care how many people want to do evil. It's still evil. If you meet an enemy's ox or his ass going astray, this is somebody you hate, but you see his animal going astray, you shall surely bring it back to him again. And it's not just, think about it, it's not just for the good of this evil person. The animal deserves some consideration as well. If you see the ass of him that is hates you lying under its burden, he's overloaded it, you shall forbear to pass by him. You shall surely release it with him. You help him out. Nor shall you rest the judgment of the poor in his cause. The fact that somebody is poor does not mean that they get to pervert justice. It's the opposite of what we've been taught. Keep yourself far from a false matter. Again, here it is. Distance yourself from falsehood, from lying, from deception, from vanity. The innocent and the righteous you are not to slay, for I will not justify the wicked. And you shall take no gift, no bribe, because a bribe or a gift blinds them that have sight and perverts the words of the righteous. A stranger you shall not oppress. For you knew the heart, the soul, the life, and the nefesh is the word in the Hebrew here, of the stranger, because you once were strangers too in the land of Mitzrayim. 6 years you shall sow your land and gather in the increase thereof. But in the seventh year, the land gets a Sabbath. You shall let it rest and lie fallow. The poor of your people may eat from it, and what they leave, the beast of the field shall eat. But you don't gather it. In like manner, you deal with your vineyard and with your olive garden, or your olive yard, orchard. 6 days you do your work. On the seventh day you shall rest, that your ox and your ass may have rest too, along with the son of your handmaid and the stranger, all of them. They get that day of rest to be refreshed. And in all the things that I've said, do you take heed? Make no mention of the name of other gods. No, don't even let them be heard out of your mouth. That one's interesting. Of course, there are places in Scripture where we read the names of those gods. But, be careful with the names of the fake gods. 3 times a year you shall keep a feast unto me. These are, of course, they're called the Feast of Ascension. And we get the outline of them here. They're going to be outlined again in Leviticus and several places in the Torah. Almost like he thinks they're important, right? The Feast of Unleavened Bread, the one that's coming up next. This Unleavened Bread feast, surrounding or at least following the time of the Passover, you shall keep. 7 days you eat unleavened bread, as I commanded you, at the time appointed in the month of Abib. This is the month you came up out of Egypt, and no one shall appear before me empty-handed or empty. And the Feast of Harvest, the first fruits of your labors, which you sow in the field. The Feast of Ingathering at the end of the year, when you gather in your labors out of the field. Okay, so the Feast of Ingathering we also know as Sukkot. 3 times in the year, all your males shall appear before Yahuwah Eloheka. You shall not offer the blood of my sacrifice with leavened bread, nor shall the fat of my feast remain all night until the morning. The choicest first fruits of your land you shall bring into the house of Yehoyarel. You shall not seethe a kid in its mother's milk. That one's an interesting one. What does it mean? Well, the best explanation I've heard is, don't do it. And it seems to have a connection with a pagan rite that was done. A lot of those details, rightfully I guess, have been lost. I'll mention this, and I'll say I don't see the connection. I've had it explained to me, but honestly, I think they're making too much out of it. Personal opinion. Your mileage may vary. Anyway, this, of course, is the place where the rabbis get this idea that you're not to have milk and meat in the same meal, and they have separate refrigerators and kosher. In other words, a cheeseburger is not kosher. But I don't see that. And, of course, if you go back and look at Abraham in Genesis, you'll see what did he offer? Milk and meat in the same meal before the Malach, the three men that came. Behold, I send a Malach before you to keep you by the way, to bring you into the place which I have prepared. So take heed of him, hearken unto his voice. Don't rebel against him, because he won't pardon your transgression, because my name is in him. Indeed, though you shall hearken to his voice, and do all that I speak, then will I be an enemy unto your enemies and an adversary unto your adversaries. Because my angel will go before you to bring you in unto the Amorite, the Hittite, the Perizzite, the Canaanite, the Hivite, and the Jebusite. And I'll cut them off. You shall not bow down to their Elohim, their fake gods, nor serve them, nor do after any of the things they do. Don't do what the Catholic Church did, in other words, and say, how do these serve their gods? I will do likewise. Right? We'll Christianize all this crap. Uh-uh. You shall entirely instead overthrow them and break in pieces. Harass is actually the root word there. And it's literally, that's literally the root word. Harass their pillars. And you shall serve Yehuyarel, and he will bless your bread and your water. I will take sickness away from the midst of you. No one shall miscarry nor be barren in your land. The number of days I will fulfill. I will send my terror before you and discomfort all the people to whom you shall come. I'll make all of your enemies turn their backs unto you. In other words, they'll flee. I will send the hornet before you, which shall drive out the Hivite and the Canaanite and the Hittite before you. I will not drive them out from you, though, just in 1 year. I'm going to be doing this in a period of time, lest the land become desolate and the beasts of the field multiply against you. Little by little will I drive them out from before you, until you're increased and able to inherit the land. And I will set your border from the Red Sea, even to the Sea of the Philistines, and from the wilderness unto the river, for I will deliver the inhabitants of the land into your hand, and you will drive them out before you. You shall make no covenant, no brit, with them, nor with their Elohim. Notice this is the one that got Joshua in trouble. They shall not dwell in your land, lest they make you stand against me, and you'll end up serving their gods. That will be a snare to you. All right, finally we get back to some of the story with Moses in chapter 24. To Moses, Yahuwah says, "Come up unto Yahuwah, you and Aaron, Nadab and Abihu, the 70 elders of Israel, and worship afar off. Moshe alone shall come near unto Yahuwah, but they shall not come near, neither shall the people go up with him." So Moses is going to come closer. Y'all just come up part way and stay a ways off. And Moses came, and the people told them all the words of Yahuwah, all the ordinances. All the people answered with one voice, a kol echad, and they said, "All of the words which Yahuwah has spoken will do." So Moshe wrote all the words of Yahuwah. He rose up early in the morning, built an altar under the mountain, 12 pillars, according to the 12 tribes of Israel. He sent the young men of the Bnei Israel, who offered burnt offerings, and sacrificed shalamim, or peace offerings, of oxen unto Yahuwah. And Moshe took half the blood, put it in basins, half he dashed against the altar. Then he took the book of the covenant, and he read in the hearing of the people. And they responded, and they said again, "All that Yahuwah has spoken we will do." And, root word, shamar, shema. We will shema. Obey. Hear and obey. So Moshe took the blood, he sprinkled it on the people, and he said, "Behold, the blood of the brit, the covenant, which Yahuwah has made with you, in agreement with all of these words." Then up went Moshe and Aaron and Nadab and Abihu and the 70 elders of Israel, and they saw the Elohim of Israel. There he was, and under his feet the like of paved work of sapphire stone. The very heavens for cleanliness, for clearness, rather. So clear, brilliant, jewel-like. Upon the nobles of the children of Israel he did not lay his hand, and they beheld God, and they ate and drank. And Elohim said unto Moshe, "Come on up to me in the mountain and be there, and I'll give you the tables of stone, the Torah, and the commandment which I have written, that you may teach them." Now notice, this one's interesting. It says the Torah and the commandment, so that you may teach them. Moshe rose up, Joshua his minister. Moshe went up to the mountain of Elohim. To the elders he said, "Tarry here," in other words, "wait here, hang out for us till we come back to you. And behold, Aaron and Hur are with you. Whoever has a cause, let them come before him." So Moshe went up to the mount. The cloud covered the mountain, and the glory of Yahuwah abode upon Mount Sinai. Cloud covered it 6 days. Seventh day, he called unto Moshe from out of the midst of the cloud, and the appearance of the glory of Yahuwah was like a devouring fire on top of the mount in the eyes of the Bnei Israel. And here is the final verse at the end of the portion. Moshe entered into the midst of the cloud, and he went up into the mountain, and he was in the mountain for 40 days and 40 nights. All right, and that's where we're going to take a break, not just with the Torah portion, but with the story as well, as you probably recall.